This is Oscar, Tom. We thought that got a hold of Don Bach and Vern Martin. He used to run the school a long time ago in the initial formation of the life support system branch, and more specifically our airman basic course. And we're just going to throw some information at you as we recall it. When you get over 60, these things don't really come easy. So you just kind of have to sort it out, but we want you to listen to it and see if you can get some information to kind of help you maybe arrange a history of some sort. Okay. Okay, we've decided after much ado trying to figure out what was going on that I just kind of bring you up to speed. In 1948, we were a parachute rigging school, and we worked under Vern Martin and Russell Carrington at that time, and we did some life support work. There was a section back where Don Bach and Rolly Turner worked that was personal equipment. That's what they used to call it. Now, originally, see, parachute rigger had a 620 MOS, and then we went to personal equipment, and we became 594s. K was added to it so that you could rig parachutes to identify that, and a V meant that you could run a high-speed sewing machine, whatever that was worth. And then, once we got started, the Air Force decided they wanted to have a rescue and survival specialist. They said, no, we want a survival training and personal equipment specialist. And we're talking about probably 1953 that we got started into this. Now, the first thing we did was, you know, we sent people out. Dale Bryant and Bobby Gillespie, who are both alive and retired from the Air Force, went down to Fort Benning, Georgia to take the parachute rigging training, paratroop training. And then they went on to a medical school in Florida, paramedic school, probably over to Gunter or somewhere at the time. And they did that part of the training. In the meantime, Captain Danko took me and a guy by the name of Tony Goba, a Forrest O. Newcomb, and a Tech Sergeant Glenn Cross out to Denver so we could sleep in the snow. And that was to train us on how to make snowshoes out of pine trees and dig holes in the snow and keep warm and do things like that. I remember I really enjoyed it because I'd been married about 3 months before. And it was great. Of course, you know the old saying, one man in a sleeping bag, two men in a sleeping bag will last for 30 years. Well, we got awful close. We did our survival training out there at Camp Carson. We did our rock scrambling up in the Red Rocks area of the state park. And we went over to Fort Carson, and they talked to us about a bunch of stuff. And we got to talk to the air rescue guys who were running a rescue unit out at Lowry at the time. Can't think of names right now. Goodlow, David K. Goodlow. Had to get him drunk before he could jump out of an airplane. I remember that.
And we had Captain Eagleson, and they were from headquarters in USAF, and they were in the Air Rescue Service. So they gave us information, and they came down and taught a few classes for us for a while.
And that was Captain Savage, who I remember him uniquely because he only fought during wartime. He was a reserve officer, but he liked to fly airplanes and kill people.
Yeah.
And that's why he came out of the reserves during the Korean War.
But you know, that was really something. You know, I'd go up to USAF for a while, and they'd never know I was coming, that they'd find me, these two guys. And they came down here several times, you remember, and helped us out. Just pop in. And they had a lot of information.
And then based on that, then you went out to Camp Ellis and negotiated for use of that camp.
That's right.
As the first survival training area for the personal equipment and personal equipment specialist and survival training. See, at that time we had both titles, and then later on we broke out into 922 and 921.
Right.
But for a long time we were just a 922. But I remember when I worked with Chief Williamson in Germany, I went to Bad Tölz, Germany first in 57 or 55 as a rescue and survival training specialist. 92171 down with the 1st Special Forces in a place called Bad Tölz, and it was the 7067th Air Intelligence Service Squad. Then, when Stead got the bad news that they were training people to be prisoners of war, overnight we cleaned up our training area and left, and I went up to Rhine, Maine, and I reported into Chief Williamson, and he didn't know what the hell I was because he was a parachute rigger running a life support job. So it got interesting, to say the least. Now, to get back to what happened, we ran officers' classes at Camp Ellis. People assigned there were Orrin T. Overson, a tech sergeant who unfortunately drowned there. Lieutenant Thompson was the second commander we had there, and he drowned. He and Sergeant Overson drowned in an unfortunate accident in a canoe. The first officer in charge out there was Lieutenant Eccles. Now, we had an assortment of people who came to us from Strategic Air Command that are like from outer space. We had a guy by the name of Odd Bjerke, who worked for the Norwegian underground and had been shot at and had six big scars on his face from a Schmeisser machine pistol when he turned a corner and a crowd ripped at him. We had a man by the name of Skrettingland, who had worked with... who was the Arctic explorer? Brent Balchen. Had worked with Balchen during World War II about getting troops out of cold weather. We had a guy from the Navy by the name of Marvin D. Sprake, who was from Kankakee, who had been to the North Pole with Richard Byrd. You got to remember that we picked these cold weather people because B-36s were able to fly maybe one way if we had to attack Russia, and we were training crews to try to survive on the ground in cold weather. The accent was on cold weather. It was a slingshot Air Force. One way was about all we were going to get. Now, the B-52 was coming on the scene, but it was a brand new piece of machinery at that time. And the old B-36 was the only thing that could fly around the world with a handball court, steam room, and all of those things that were in there. And we did train people on escape and evasion, map and compass work, because they were supposed to get out of there and go to free areas. So then it evolved that we sent people out to McCall, Idaho, up on the Snake River. And took a number of the officers' courses out there to do field training with them. Now, the enlisted people didn't get field survival training until Stead Air Force Base opened up, and then we got an arrangement with them, and then they really started doing the survival training part for our 922s.
You see, the starting on that, the SAC really had the survival training program to start with. And then when we started to combine those things, then we got together and put them on training command.
Wasn't Camp Carson one of the initial?
That's right.
Camp Carson was first.
Contact point.
Yeah. And then Stead, because that's where the SAC got their training programs out there. At that particular time, see, we combined all of those, the air service training, the survival training, and the first equipment officer, all into one AFSC. See, we took it over from the SAC.
Right, and that's where the officers got their 10-420 MOS or AFSC at that time. Yeah, and then they became a 14-15A and a 14-35. We had numbers change there over the years just as the thing evolved.
Yeah, 15-15A.
Yeah, 15-15A, that's right. Operation support, life support somewhere in there. And we got a lot of good men. At that time, we picked up officers in class like Jim Jacoby, Chuck Lehman. They're all either first lieutenants or captains, wore their sunglasses and sat in the back row and was very quiet. We had Don Muir and a number of other people. George Brow and his gas chamber guys came up, and we had a whole bunch of his enlisted men went through the officer's course with Brow. Nick, can't think of his last name, that ran life support in Clark came in. It was interesting, the number of people that evolved, and they ended up in leadership positions in the life support area as the years passed. Most all of us, a bunch of us made a career out of it.
And there wasn't a word said by anybody except those two generals, one from Air Rescue Service, one from SAC. They were taking over survival seat. You know what I mean. Those two guys were the ones that were, you know, they knew it was going to training command because they'd been told that. So we didn't have to say a thing. We just sat there and listened, you know. And it was rightly so, because both those generals were not very happy about anything going on there, you know. Air Rescue Service didn't want to give up their current part of it. And certainly Stead didn't want to, I mean, Staff didn't want to give up their part, you know.
SAC had it at Camp Carson.
Camp Carson, Camp Carson, it was their
mountain division, cold weather training.
Yeah, right, that's where it was right there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the whole complete AFSC, it was just mountain training.
It was mountain training. Right. Because what happened here is I found some more paperwork, and this might be of interest. Cold weather operations in Colorado, April to July of 53. Shelter construction, campsite location, navigation, food procurement, river crossing, tree climbing, fire building on the Sangamon River in Illinois.
Yeah.
Knot and rope work in the area, water survival equipment at the pool, static survival training camp, July the 28th to 16 July 1954, Desolation Valley, Tahoe National Forest, California. Desert training, Smoke Creek Desert, 19th through the 23rd of July, 1954. River rafting techniques, the whole day of the 22nd of July, 1954, in the Truckee River in California. We did suspension traverses across, and we built rafts. What a hell of a day that was. Seashore training, we were from 26th of July to 31st of July at the Pacific Ocean area on Point Arena, California. Vic Crist was my partner. I had a hell of a good time because he knew things about scallops and prawns and some other kind of seafood. Smelt. We put poles through our field jackets at night, went out with flashlight when smelt were running, and just scooped those little bastards up on the shore as fast as we could by the hundreds, and then boiled a grease in a GI butt can and just dropped them in there and ate them guts and all. We did Operation Long Walk. 1st of August to the 20th of August, 1954, in the Tahoe National Forest in California. And that's where we learned a lot of stuff about doing rope work, rock climbing, the whole shot. And that's about what I have off of this old record as far as the field training that I took. And of course, then we always went out to Camp Carson and looked over the side of there. And then we went to Stead, and we ran our instructors in and out of Stead continuously. And then finally, after Stead got done, we got done with Stead, then we started training on Chanute, in the back section of Chanute, Tony Goba, and I don't remember who was there then because I was gone, but I remember
Kirby.
They were doing it back.
And then going into Camp Ellis.
Yeah, Kirby.
Kirby, I think,
yeah.
Was one of them. And Gablehouse, I think.
Yeah, we're at Gablehouse, that's right. And then we went out to Camp Ellis, and that's where we did the training, and we lost the officer and the NCO, Lieutenant Thompson and Sergeant Overson. And we ran that until it ran into the ground, and then we came back to it. Didn't Tony go out to Wright-Patterson and run a school for a while? Or was that just a summer, a loan? He was on loan.
I think maybe a loan.
Yeah, Anthony Vincent Gobo was a unique individual. He had a son, a ski bum professional, and he was an excellent addition to our staff.
You see, when you guys were out there on the ocean training, the survival training out there, that was still under Stead. I mean, under...
Glenn Hawkins, that civilian out there,
Red.
Yeah.
And that was before it combined and was given over to training command.
Right.
You guys are getting your training out there.
Right.
And then they closed that down after we got the whole thing here at Chanute. See, they closed it down when we started our training here.
Tom, I'm going to throw a whole group of names in for whatever historical significance they might have. No particular chronological sequence. Starting off with some of the civilian troops, might just as well get where it all started. We had Vernon C. Martin was the civilian in charge. We had others came in, Harold Bateman, William Wilcoxon. We had a civilian never got onto the PE survival side, Clifford Green. We had three ladies out here, Mona Gregory, Maxine Durkin, and Ina Powell. As far as I know, they're still all alive and kicking. We had a number of other civilians get involved with the personal equipment officer, George Laird, William Truesdale, Bobby Williamson, William Searles, and some of the officers coming up through the system. We had James Pickett, a clever supply type, got involved in much of the operation. Major Alexander, Warrant Officer Gerald Ramagus, Captain Danko, Lieutenant Cobry, Lieutenant Thompson. Lieutenant Thompson being one that Hosky mentioned drowned out at Camp Ellis, along with Orrin Overson, Tech Sergeant, a couple of the losses we had. And just continuing ahead, some of the initial airman types, Dale D. Bryant, Donald G. Davis, B.D. Gillespie, Oscar E. Norberg, James C. Hayes, Joe Heldreth, Robert Black, Darryl Brown, Carl B. Jennings, Todd Fleming, Raleigh Turner, Herman Martin, Herb Bergkamp, Richard L. Fickenworth. Okay, going to continue with more names for whatever significance they might serve. We also had Virgil Helpenstein, Elmer Giebelhaus, and Bobby Crawford, two involved with the ammunition explosion out at Stead, had some eye problems, minor to serious injuries, I guess. And Staff Sergeant Mason, Tech Sergeant Collins, Sergeant Jesse Tucker, R.L. Fickenworth, Anthony Golba, Oliver T. McLean, Clarence Benton, Bernie Quick, the Bausch twins, Rich Agaki, Mike Weaver, Carl Galicknick, Bob Hardcastle, Francis King, Henry Luke, Pat Kerr, Lyle Johnson, Tom Chase, Lyle Loading, Luther Hively, Dennis Metter, Donald G. LaCrosse, Dennis Kirkley, Joe Abernathy, Joe Caldwell, I understand Joe is now deceased, Paul Ferguson, Nick the Greek, that's the best we can put together, Tech Sergeant Wilton Stewart, Staff Sergeant Jerry Stewart, Chas Lauer, Richard Nicholas, George Campbell, one you'll recognize, Bob Tompkins, Andy Everett, Bernie Ebert, Hansen, can't come up with the first name, Enrique Ojeda, Forrest Newcomb, Corporal Kirby, can't come up with first name, Ken Bechtel, Michael Kramer, Bernard Hockett, Tom Tibbetts, and Roger Davidson. And then want to give special recognition to a Captain Glenn O. Eagleson and a Lieutenant Savage, first name we can't come up with, who were so vital in the closing out of the air rescue service and SAC survival training sections and bringing them into the air training command.
Okay, what I wanted to do is, we have a training project outline here dated 18th January 1955. It's called Survival Training, a Personal Equipment Specialist, and this is the student workbook, and I'm sure some of you guys will remember this. Introduction to survival, you were supposed to fill out questions. Characteristics of Arctic areas, characteristics of desert areas. Where is the Arabian Desert located? Characteristics of tropical areas. What's the dominating weather factor in the tropics? How is the wind and aid ocean navigation under characteristics of seas and oceans? Medical procedures and personal hygiene under survival conditions. This was anatomy and physiology. Remember the 27 bones in the face? What are the functions of what is a voluntary muscle? What's an involuntary muscle? What's diastolic blood pressure? Remember, you guys used to really buckle down and get into this. Medical procedures and personal hygiene under survival conditions. This is stress now. Six steps for treatment of shock. How is a sucking chest wound treated? What are heat cramps? We had more medical personal hygiene, and this time we're talking about treatment of fractures. What's a compound? What's a simple? Medical procedures and personal hygiene. Again, this is preventive medicine and oral hygiene. Why do you brush your teeth? How can the necessary intake of salt be accomplished in hot climates? How can you get this salt? What's the cause of snow blindness? Then we talk about building fires, fire building. How can wet logs be used for fuel? You rub two Indians together and then you get something going there. Campsite location and shelter construction. Remember this up in the Plumas and up in the Rubicon Valley? Some of the guys that went through Stead would remember that. What type of materials used in the construction of a barren land tent? What's the purpose of a windbreak? Improvised survival clothing? What's a Hudson Bay duffel? Can muckluck boots be improvised from a parachute assembly? Remember how we learned to cut up a parachute, all different kinds of pieces to make wonderful clothes, including breech cloths. Water sources and purification. What's the difference between old sea ice and new sea ice? how do you get liquid from liana vines? Those of you who went through the that were Vietnam veterans went down through the school of Clark. You know all about that. Location identification of food. I always was told, I think Tompkins, you told me, or somebody, it was Glenn LaCrosse, says any warm-blooded fur-bearing animal can be eaten raw. And that caused me a lot of trouble in bars. Anyway, the next one is on procurement of food. What's the purpose of stalking an animal? Traps and snares. What's a deadfall? That's when you fall off the stool when you've had too much to drink. Cooking in the field. Why should freshwater fish and shellfish always be cooked? How about the old rock oven? I think we all remember that, where they slaughter the deer, poor little Bambi, and then put her down in there with all them hot rocks and leaves and junk, and then you got to eat it. Conventional improvised communications, laying out signals on the ground, body signals, which is the left light on an aircraft when they make a left turn or a right turn. In a water landing, how long should the area be? If you're going to have an emergency airstrip, remember I was supposed to pick up a guy weighed 200 pounds and walk down the center of the proposed landing strip, and if my heel sunk in too deep, then you couldn't land a Goonie bird there. Principles of land navigation. Most of you know that the top of the map was north. I think about all we got out of that, and working with the compass. East is least, west is best. Travel under survival conditions, using a tump line. Describe procedures for traveling a straight line over rough terrain. It ain't easy. How to build a raft. Those of you in the class that I took out to Stead, the first one was we built the raft on the Rubicon in a day. General principles of native psychology. Don't mess with the natives. How do Arabs welcome distinguished visitors? Usually with gunfire. Two types of natives found in the desert. What's the purpose of letting the natives talk to you? Why is it important to leave native women alone? Anybody who's been in Southeast Asia knows that. And that concludes that workbook.
Tom, I want to throw in one added item might be of some value to you. I've got an address here that I was told would have a historical record of all of the CTSs, STSs, etc., which would identify the various MOSs, AFSCs, and so on. The address is Headquarters, USAF HRA, Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama, ZIP 36112-6678, telephone area code 205-953-5342. Ask for the Inquiries Division, and they should be able to assist if you can use that type data.